Chester Ronning was born to Lutheran missionary parents December 13, 1894, the first non-Chinese person to be born in the walled city of Fancheng in the province of Hubei in East Central China. His father was Halvor Nielsen Ronning, a native of Telemark, Norway. His mother, Hannah Rorum, was born in Illinois to Norwegian immigrant parents. Chester was the second oldest of seven Ronning children. He had three brothers and three sisters. His life led Chester Ronning to many corners of the world, and yet he always returned to his adopted home of Alberta, and in particular, the central Alberta farming community of Camrose. He lived for many years in an unpretentious house less than a city block from Camrose Lutheran College. One of Chester Ronning's greatest admirers was the longtime Alberta leader of the NDP, Grant Nutley. We talked about Ronning with Nutley prior to his own death in a plane crash earlier this year.
Chester Ronning has always been a little bit of a hero to me. He's a person who is, I think, in terms of his character, is just unimpeachable. He's a man of great conviction, great compassion, understanding. He's one of the most literate people I've ever run into. And so it's always been a source of some real pride to me that I know Chester Ronning. And that I've had a little bit of an opportunity in my lifetime to rub shoulders with a person that I consider to be a genuinely great Albertan, a great Canadian.
Camrose newspaper editor Bertie Fowler knew Chester Ronning since the 1930s.
I think it seemed to be obvious in every part of his life that he had a concern for people, whether they were students or whether they were farmers or other people that were suffering during the Depression. Because of his background with missionary parents in China, he had a global concern, I think, for people.
Paul Martin was Canada's Secretary of State for External Affairs when Ronning was concluding his diplomatic career in the mid-1960s.
He was our High Commissioner in India, and I had known him off and on for, oh, I should say about 20 years. He is undoubtedly one of our distinguished ex-diplomats, and a man who I thought would be of great help in our efforts to try and bring about peace in Vietnam.
Chester Ronning was a storyteller, and many stories were told about him. Former teacher Ed Martin recalls a fundraising campaign Ronning organized while principal of Camrose Lutheran College in the 30s.
He wrestled with a fellow over in Viking. This fellow wasn't going to give any money to the college. So Chester says, I'll tell you what, I'll wrestle you, and if I win, then you give the college some money, and if I lose, why, you don't have to pay. So he wrestled with this fellow, and he won the wrestling match and broke a couple of ribs and tore his shirt and whatnot, but he got the money.
The National Film Board of Canada describes Chester Ronning as one of the most fascinating characters in the history of modern China. In 1980, the Film Board released a film entitled China Mission, The Chester Ronning Story. The director was Tom Radford.
We were just getting the film out of the lab in Montreal, and we have to look at it in a screening theater there to make sure that all of the quality control things have worked out. People started coming in out of the halls in Montreal at the big film board lab there, and people who we'd asked to come in and just look at the first copy of the film with us, but just people who over the years had kind of known and followed his life.
A University of Alberta publication describes Ronning as perhaps one of the more interesting people most of us are ever likely to encounter. Chinese was Ronning's first language, followed by Norwegian and only then English. As a child, Chester spoke English with his mother, Norwegian with his father, and Chinese when conversing with both parents. In 1907, just before the revolution which resulted in the establishment of the Republic of China, the Ronning family left the country for Radcliffe, Iowa. Then came a period of homesteading, first at Bardo, southeast of Edmonton, and later in the Peace River country. Chester Ronning was educated at the North China Union Language School in Peking, the universities of Minnesota and Alberta, Waterloo Lutheran University in Ontario, and the Camrose Normal School, where he received his teacher's certificate in 1917. On September 9th of 1918, Ronning married Inga Marie Horting at Valhalla in the Peace River area. They went on to have 6 children. The next quarter century, Chester Ronning devoted to the field of education. Around 1920, he served as assistant principal at 2 Edmonton schools, Queen Alexandra Public and H.A. Gray Junior High, before spending a year teaching at the University of Minnesota. The mid-20s saw Ronning back in China, first continuing his education in Peking, and then serving as principal at a Chinese school in his birthplace of Fancheng. It was at this time that Ronning first became aware of a man named Zhou Enlai, who many years later became premier of Communist China. The paths of Chester Ronning and Zhou Enlai crossed several times over the years, as described by Ronning with typical recall of detail following Zhou's death in 1976.
I knew of him when I was in China as a teacher from 1922 to 1927. I knew of him when I was a student in Peking, and I knew of him when I was a teacher in my hometown in China. And some of my friends kept up a correspondence with him during the time that he was in France studying and working. And I met him after I'd known about him for many years. I met him in Chongqing when I was when I went out as a foreign service officer in the service of the Canadian External Affairs in Chongqing. I met him just 2 days after I arrived. I had dinner with him. General Victor W. Ottlum, our ambassador out there, and I was the only Foreign Service officer with him at that time, we had dinner with Zhou Enlai, and his interpreter was the Chinese ambassador who is now representing China in Ottawa, Zhang Wenjin. He was Zhou Enlai's interpreter, and I was General Ottlum's interpreter. So that's where it started. And I knew him later during the Civil War when I was in 19. And I met him in Geneva for the Korean Conference, for the Laos Conference. And I saw him in India when he was negotiating with, when I saw him in India when I was the Canadian High Commissioner to India and lived in Delhi, when he was there negotiating with Mr. Nehru. And then I saw him again in 1971 when I went out to visit China. He invited us for dinner, and we had several hours together with him on more than one occasion. And then in 1973, I saw him again when my daughter Audrey and my granddaughter Susan, Audrey's daughter, were in China in 73. And again, we spent several hours with him.
In 1927, at the direction of the British consul in China, Chester Ronning left the country, arriving in Camrose, where he went on to serve as principal of Camrose Lutheran College until 1942. Camrose newspaper editor Bertie Fowler first met Ronning in the 30s.
I can recall that as principal of the college, from time to time, new students arrived, and there used to be a general assembly every morning. And if there were new students in the group, he would give a little talk, which in effect says, okay, I know that this is your first day here, and I know that you feel confused and strange, and you don't know who's who and where to go and what to do. We understand that, and we will help you as much as we can. But in whatever words he used to express it, the message was left quite clearly. We know what you're up against, but we expect that you're going to cope and adjust quite quickly, and everything's going to be okay. And I think because he had the ability to show that he empathized completely with how the student felt, then it brought the response that, okay, he expects me to adjust. He seems to know what I'm going through. He thinks I can do it, so I guess I can. And I think he had tremendous abilities in that regard.
Bertie Fowler recalls Chester Ronning as an imaginative administrator.
I remember an occasion when Ben Hur was playing at the Bailey Theater, and the, I'll say the Board of Regents, but whatever governing authority at the time, would not permit the students to go to the theater. But Ben Hur was a classic that the English students were taking, and of course they wanted to go. And Chester Ronning said to them when they asked for permission to go, "I can't give you permission, but I'm going to it myself." And that was the beginning of change in that regard at the college.
Former Camrose teacher Ed Markin remembers Chester Ronning, the teacher.
I suppose to use a phrase, an ideal teacher. I never took any classes from them, but I heard a lot of reports from students who did, and they really liked him as a teacher. Not strict in the sense of being, bossy in class or anything like that, but very considerate of students, a good disciplinarian. I never saw him angry, never.
Bertie Fowler credits Chester Ronning as having been responsible for survival of Camrose Lutheran College during the difficult times of the Depression.
It perhaps is a little known fact that in the Depression years, there just was no money to operate that college. And Chester Ronning was one of two people who said, when the decision was made whether or not they would keep the college open or close it, Chester Ronning and one other man said, "You keep it open and we will teach. And how we get paid will remain to be seen." Had the college closed, one doesn't know whether it would ever have reopened again or not. So I think that that is a very significant contribution.
Former teacher Ed Markin tells the story of the unusual way Chester Ronning managed to secure a donation for the Camrose College.
There was a farmer out by Viking that had quite a few sons. I don't think I better mention their names, but Chester was out there soliciting money for the new hardwood floors. And this is back in the 30s. Depression years, there wasn't very much money. All the grown-up sons decided that they'd give so much each. One gave so much and another one so much and so on. And then one of them, who was quite a husky fellow, said, "No, I'm not giving the college any money. They can't afford it." Chester said, "Oh, you can afford at least $5, couldn't you, for the floor?" "No, I'm not giving you money." So Chester said, "I tell you what," he said, "I'll take my jacket off and we'll wrestle. And if you win the wrestling match, you don't have to pay. And if I win the wrestling match, then you give the college, I forget how much, $25 or something." So he agreed, and Chester didn't know whether he could lick this guy or not, because he was quite a bit heftier, but Chester told me afterwards that he had taken some wrestling lessons when he was a student at the University of Minnesota. But he knew a little bit about some of the wrestling holds and stuff. So they wrestled, and Chester got him down. He got a lock on them. I forget what they call it. And Chester said he was almost ready to holler give up because the guy was it pretty good hold on him. But finally the fellow said, "I give up." The Chester one. But he had a terrific pain in his side. And when he got back to Camelot, he went to the doctor and found out that he had 3 broken ribs. And his shirt was torn from top to bottom at the back, a brand new shirt that he bought the day before he went out there.
During his tenure at Camrose Lutheran, Chester Ronning became involved in provincial politics, eventually being chosen first leader of the Cooperative Commonwealth Federation, or CCF, forerunner to the New Democratic Party. Longtime Alberta NDP leader, the late Grant Nutley, in an interview earlier this year, explained the evolution of the party and Ronning's involvement.
The UFA governed Alberta from 1921 until 1935. Mr. Ronning himself was elected as a member of the legislature in the early 1930s. He represented the Camrose constituency. He was elected as a CCF UFA candidate in the early 30s, as a matter of fact, 1932. There was a conference in Calgary at which a number of groups, including the UFA, got together and decided to form a new party, and that, of course, became the CCF. The CCF, after its organization in Calgary in 1932, continued as a party until 1961, for almost 30 years. And in 1961, it merged with other groups to form the Democratic Party of Canada.
Grant Nutley explained that Ronning's career in provincial politics ended when he was succeeded as CCF leader by the man who later became the mayor of Edmonton.
In the 1930s, when the CCF was formed, he had been a member of the Legislative Assembly. And after the election of 1935, when the UFA was defeated, there was some question for a little while as to whether or not the UFA would continue as the political force in Alberta, or whether the CCF would be its natural successor. By the late 30s, the UFA had decided to abandon politics, and those UFAers who were strongly committed to the CCF banded together and formally launched the CCF as an official political party in Alberta. Chester Ronning became its first leader. And he held that leadership position until the early 40s. He went overseas, and in 1942, there was a by-election in the city of Edmonton, and Elmer Roper, who was later mayor of Edmonton, was elected to the legislature. At that time, there was no CCF member in the Alberta legislature. The UFA had been completely wiped out in 1935. So when Mr. Roper became a member of the legislature in 1942, shortly after that, he became the leader and served as leader of the CCF from 1943 until 1956. You know, it's one of the tragedies in public life that sometimes people of unusual ability are defeated when other people of, at best, a common ability get themselves elected. But in a democratic society, we have to, you know, have to take what comes. And sometimes what comes is the less than the best people get themselves elected. But so be it. And Chester Ronning wouldn't want any different. And he was a he was a great Democrat and a great socialist and a great humanitarian, and I think a great Christian. And it's very few people, but left as positive a mark, at least in my life, as Chester Ronning.
Part of World War II saw Ronning serve as head of the Discrimination Unit of Royal Canadian Air Force Intelligence in Ottawa. Following the war, it was back to China, where Ronning held the positions of Foreign Service Officer at the Canadian embassies in Chongqing and Nanking, and charge d'affaires at Nanking. In a 1979 interview, Chester Ronning recalled that Canadians in China often were mistaken for Americans by the Chinese.
When we moved down from Chongqing, we moved the government, the Canadian representation from Chongqing, when the Chinese moved their government back to Nanking. When we moved down there, we had a jeep. That was our mode of transportation. And wherever we went, we looked like, this is Bill Bostock, I mean, he was the military attaché, he always did the driving. when they saw us, they thought this was an American jeep, and they thought we were Americans, so they called out, "Negro Indian Hall!" And I decided that we should make it, let people who didn't know that we were Canadians. So I had Chinese characters put just below the windshield in front, large characters, "Jia Na Da Guo." Da Su Guan. "Jia Na Da" is Canada. Yeah. Canadian Embassy. So that it would realize that we were not American.
Closing the Canadian Embassy in 1951, Chester Ronning was the last official Canadian government representative to leave China after the communists seized control of the mainland. In his words at the time, "I leave here with a heavy heart because I have not been able to accomplish that for which I have been working and waiting all this time, recognition of the real government of China." After 2 years in Ottawa as head of the American and Far Eastern Division of the Department of External Affairs, Ronning in 1953 became a member of the Canadian delegation to the United Nations General Assembly in New York. The next dozen years saw Chester Ronning represent Canada in a number of world capitals in various capacities, including ambassador to Norway and high commissioner to India. Ronning served as acting head of the Colombo Plan Conference in Tokyo and as acting leader of the Canadian delegations to Geneva conferences on Korea and Laos. He retired from the diplomatic service in 1965. It was in the early 60s that a young Grant Nutley, later to become Alberta NDP leader, first met Chester Ronning.
I think the first time that I recall meeting Mr. Ronning was in the early 60s, just after he came back from India as High Commissioner. He was in Camrose. It struck me that he was living in a very modest little house, and for a person as famous as Mr. Ronning, I guess that's the first thing that went through my mind. That would have been about 1963 or 64, I think, just shortly after he returned to High Commissioner in any event from India. And I found him a very engaging individual, and at that time he was, of course, very knowledgeable about international affairs. Things were just beginning to heat up in Vietnam. He had very strong views about American involvement in Vietnam, and I remember discussing that matter with him.
In the mid-60s, Ronning became increasingly critical of American involvement in Southeast Asia, and particularly in Vietnam. Again, the late Grant Nutley.
He had a very strong moral abhorrence to what was going on in Vietnam. He was proved right, of course. The tragedy for the Western world is that nobody in the United States government had the understanding in Southeast Asia that Chester Ronning had. On the other hand, the Canadian government simply wasn't strong enough to make its concerns about the region known to the United States. And so, as a result, not understanding the history or the background of the people, the United States got involved in a war which drained away, you know, billions of dollars, cost hundreds of thousands of lives, including many, many American lives as well. And it was one of the most regrettable episodes in the history of the United States. And Chester Ronning spoke out against that war, and it was not just a political attack he took. He understood the region. He, of course, had been born in China and knew the history of China and saw the development of not only that country, but other nations in Southeast Asia. I don't think there was any man who worked for either the United States or Canadian government who had a better understanding of the detailed problems of that area of the world. And so it's a tragedy that he wasn't able to make his moral concern more clearly felt in the offices of people who actually wielded power.
Twice after his retirement from the diplomatic service, Chester Ronning was sent by the Canadian government under Prime Minister Lester Pearson to the North Vietnamese capital in a bid by Ottawa to initiate peace talks between Hanoi and Washington. Minister of External Affairs from 1963 to 68, Paul Martin, recalls the times.
The President of the United States had made an important speech in San Antonio, saying that he would welcome the efforts of any country, all countries, in trying to bring about a ceasefire in the war in Vietnam. Long before that declaration by President Johnson, of course, Mr. Pearson and I had discussions with him about the war. There was never any doubt about our position about it. We never were enthusiastic or never really in favor of it. I thought, Pearson thought, the government thought, that Canada should make an effort to see if something couldn't be done to bring the parties together and to bring about a ceasefire, to try and avoid an expansion of that tragic conflict.
Paul Martin explains the reasons for selecting Chester Running for the peace mission.
I decided, after thinking about the matter and talking about it with my colleagues, that Chester Running was a suitable man to send on that kind of mission. He had been born in China. He spoke Mandarin. He had met Ho Chi Minh and knew some of the other personalities in the government in Hanoi. The Americans weren't happy with our selection of Chester. They had known something of his views about the war, which were not any different than our own, although our responsibility was a different one, because we were a government carrying on normal relations with the United States. And I suppose Chester's advanced views were abundant. Certainly they were to Mr. Rusk, the Secretary of State. They weren't very happy at his choice, but that was a matter for us to decide. And as a country with an independent point of view, we thought that there could be no better man than Chester Running.
The former External Affairs Minister recalls the first of Chester's two visits to Hanoi.
Was received, first of all, by the Foreign Ministry, and then by the Prime Minister, Tham Long. He received from Tham Long the assurance that there could be talks if the American attacks on the North stopped, particularly the bombing. Now that was an important bit of news. I don't say that it was original, but it was a statement by the North that there was some movement open which could lead to an exchange of views, which in turn might lead to a ceasefire, or at any rate to negotiations. He was well received when he arrived in the North. He was received by a band and could not have been more warmly received, particularly by the Prime Minister, than he was. And the Chester Running felt, and we felt, that he had brought out back something significant. The Americans took some time, however, in processing the information that was passed on to them here in Washington, where Chester had gone with some of our officials to discuss his report with the Americans. I was a little concerned at the delay in receiving from the Americans the kind of reply that they would make. At that time, I was not aware, nor was anyone else, of other peace efforts that were being made in Rangoon by UTAMP, or by someone on behalf of UTAMP, for the same purpose. I called Washington and told them that Ronning would have to return to Hanoi and to pass on to Hanoi the American reaction, whatever it was. As I say, there was some delay in getting the kind of response in that context of the Americans which I regarded as essential. However, I gave instructions for Ronning to return, and by that time we had received the American reaction. They thought there was nothing substantial in what he brought back. We would report that. And when he did, of course, the North were somewhat mystified, I suppose. But they did acknowledge that we had made an effort. And they indicated to us clearly that they wanted the channel which existed through the Ronning visit to be kept open.
The former Minister of External Affairs assesses the significance of Chester Ronning's peace missions.
I think it was a very important and useful visit. He did bring back some slight movement on the part of the North. If the bombing had stopped, even temporarily. He had been told that the foreign conditions which the North had been proclaiming would not be required as a condition for peace talks, if not for peace talks, at least for preliminary negotiations. And that was a movement. And that came in within the terms of the American position as publicly stated by the President.
Paul Martin concedes the Americans were not pleased with the choice of Chester Ronning for the peace initiative.
There was a feeling that Mr. Ronning was not the kind of person to send. We didn't share that view. I thought he was very much the kind of person to send. He was a man who was against the war. He was a man who was known as a man of progressive ideas. That would give him standing in the eyes of Hanoi. They knew him by reputation. And if the Americans were not satisfied with him as an emissary, they could not help but note that we were satisfied. And if we had decided to send him, that was our business.
In an interview at the end of the war, Ronning stated it was Chinese presence in Vietnam which caused the American people to pressure their government to end its involvement in the conflict.
Both China and the Soviet Union assisted the North Vietnamese. I suppose that if China particularly participated in the military activities against the United States, that if China hadn't given that assistance, the United States people could not have stopped the war. You see, it was the rising up of the antagonism of the people of the United States against the government of the United States that forced the United States to finally give up. But it was Chinese assistance that created the situation which forced the United States to give up on account of the attitude of the people of the United States, which was a very, very important factor.
It was in 1970 that Canada finally recognized the communist regime as the legitimate government of China. Former External Affairs Minister Paul Martin.
I know that he was urging that on us, and had been for some time. His views on recognition were well known. They antedated our own by a number of years. When we took the step of urging that China be admitted to the United Nations in 1965, that we did that by abstaining on a resolution that called for the expulsion of Taiwan from the UN and the ceding of China. That step was certainly one that he applauded. He would have preferred to see us go further at that time. And certainly he would have approved the step that was taken in the 70s to recognize the regime.
U.S. recognition of China took effect nearly a decade later, on January 1st, 1979, and the announcement came just before Christmas, 1978. Chester Ronning was reached by telephone in Washington, D.C.
Of course, I was delighted to realize that the United States had finally done what it should have done decades ago. I advocated in 1951 that all the NATO nations should immediately recognize Canada. Took some time to accept my recommendation, but it is not entirely unexpected. Although it was, for me, it was unexpected. But people here who have some knowledge of the negotiations were not too surprised. But I was, and I was delightfully surprised because President Nixon, you know, about the only thing that I approved of his activities during the time that he was the president of the United States was that he accepted Mr. Kissinger's recommendations to move toward recognition of the People's Republic of China in Peking and withdraw recognition from the Chiang Kai-shek government in Taiwan.
Former Camrose newspaper reporter Margaret Tanko says of Chester Ronning, perhaps one of his most valuable assets in his relations with China, more than his ability to converse fluently in the language, was an understanding of the Chinese people and their history, and an ability to see the country and its inhabitants not as an outsider looking in, but rather as one of them. Three times in the 70s, Ronning traveled to China as a private citizen at the invitation of the Chinese government. Zhou Enlai, the late Chinese premier, was among the men Ronning admired most, as demonstrated in an interview following Zhou's death in 1976.
I would say that he is, in my estimation, the greatest statesman that of China has been, the greatest statesman of the China has had in modern times. He was very friendly, and of course he has been very friendly to people who are interested in China. Zhou Enlai has been the one person who has been most responsible for carrying out the ideology which has been proposed by Mao Zedong. He has been most responsible for carrying out that policy and for the organization that has brought that policy to that has transformed China as a result of carrying out that policy.
Chester Ronning wrote a couple of books, including A Memoir of China in Revolution, published by Pantheon Books in 1974. The National Film Board of Canada says Ronning had a mission to bring to the West an understanding of a civilization which is one of the world's most ancient, and also, as reflected in the events of Ronning's life, one of its most revolutionary. The Fillmore describes Ronning's personality as one of the most fascinating, complex, and attractive ever portrayed on film. Released in 1980, the Fillmore's hour-long production of China Mission, the Chester Ronning story, was directed by Tom Radford.
First talking to him about the possibility of a film, and at that time I thought the film should be a film about China, basically returning to China with Chester and kind of following the story of his years there. And as a film like this costs a great deal of money to make, and over the 2 or 3 years that we basically were able to put together the funding for the film, the idea just kind of grew into a story that China was very important to, but Canada was equally important. And I think it's one of the great things of his life is that although, you know, he's been instrumental in the modern history of Asia from a North American point of view, his life has been equally dedicated to work here in Canada, whether it be in the Camrose area or Edmonton or up in the Peace River country, and of course his years in Ottawa. So it was the Canadian side of the story just grew in size for us and became equal in weight to the China side. At the start of the project, we wanted to make a film about China, and as I say, the story kind of just dictated itself, though, as it went along.
Filmmaker Tom Radford expands on the fact that China Mission went beyond Chester Ronning's time in China.
As I said, you know, when we started the film, we just thought it was basically going to be a China film. Then the Canadian side of the story began to really grow on us, and not only Chester's years with the Camrose Lutheran College, but his years with the United Farmers Party in the 30s, but his work and adventures, if you like, as a homesteader and a horse breaker up in the Peace River country in 1911 to 1920, that area. That whole Canadian side of the story is told, plus the international side of his life other than China, because I think the Norwegian posting and the India posting and the Vietnam mission all are very important parts of his life, and all those are covered in the film.
Radford explains that Ronning took an active part in producing the film.
And some films are made more by filmmakers and less, I guess, by the subject of the film. I think this would be the kind of film that would be just the opposite. The whole film basically is Chester Ronning, and it was only able to be made because he really let us share part of his life over a couple of years, and we basically end up just being mirrors to a lot of the different things he did in that time. Plus, you know, really being incredibly generous with us in terms of all of the family photographs that we were able to kind of bring together from different members of the family of what life was like in China at the turn of the century, and what life was like in China when he went back from Camrose in 1921 to be a teacher in China, and then, you know, going back to China in the 40s again leaving Camrose to go to our wartime embassy in Chongqing. Each one of those sections, you know, were only possible to be able to make with the family photographs and with Chester basically providing the narrative. So it was the kind of film where we kind of, by necessity, had to live in his right pocket for a couple of years.
China Mission director Tom Radford says the film was important to Alberta and to Canada.
The country, I think, is so desperately in need of people who have had a vision of the country and who come very definitely from a region of it like Chester does, but have such a strong feeling and such a strong faith in Canada as a country and its place in the world. And I think films like China Mission right now are so important to this country. It's not as important. It's funny, you know, you make a film about a Canadian whose great work was in China or in India. That, I think, but the great use of the film is going to be here in this country. And the beginning of this country right now, this seems to be getting so increasingly divided. Everybody thinks that if you're a strong Albertan, you have to somehow be not as much a Canadian anymore, which obviously is a great tragedy. And the more we can make films about our history, which show people who are very strong regionalists, if you like, but who also, or who were strong internationalists, but who were also strong nationalists, strong Canadians, that we just need to make more films like that.
Chester Ronning was predeceased by his wife, the former Inga Marie Horte, in 1967. Camrose newspaper editor Bertie Fowler remembers Mrs. Ronning.
She was quiet and yet had a fine sense of humor. And I suppose was willing to be the secondary mate. She was quite willing to let him be in the spotlight. And I'm sure that she was never any problem in terms of wanting the spotlight for herself in any way. I think she made every effort to fulfill the duties of a diplomat, and to my knowledge, she never made any mistakes.
Bertie Fowler recalls that Mrs. Ronning felt there was one major disadvantage to being the wife of a diplomat.
I sometimes felt that, and this is just a personal feeling, that perhaps it was almost too bad that he had such prominence, which made it very difficult for her to make a personal mark. But certainly this was never at any time suggested by her. She was a family kind of person, and although she certainly cooperated with his diplomatic appointments and the requirements that were made of her, she did regret the fact that because of that, her family was scattered all over the world.
Her children.
And she mentioned with some regret that she had grandchildren that she rarely saw. At the particular time, I recall she had some that she hadn't even seen. And she said she felt rather envious of people whose families are close and accessible.
The year 1972 saw appointment as Companion of the Order of Canada for Chester Ronning, a man who also received honorary doctorates from the universities of Alberta, Calgary, and Lethbridge, Simon Fraser University in Burnaby, B.C., Waterloo Lutheran University in Ontario, and St. Olaf College in Northfield, Minnesota. Companion of the Order of Canada is one of the highest honors awarded by the Canadian federal government. Ronning was a member of the Senate of the University of Alberta through much of the 70s. His adopted hometown of Camrose has a Chester Ronning school. Newspaper editor Bertie Fowler says Ronning will be remembered for his ability to mingle with people in all walks of life.
He would feel as much at ease and comfortable and interested in conversation with a Chinese person working on the rice paddies as he would with royalty or some of the best-known statesmen in the world. And what I think is probably even more important, I believe any of those individuals would feel at complete ease speaking to him. I'm sure that the peasant on the rice paddies would feel quite comfortable talking to him as well.
I'm Pete Hicks for CFCW News. Educator, politician, diplomat Chester Ronning has died at the age of 90. Funeral service will be held Friday afternoon at 2 o'clock at Messiah Lutheran Church in Camrose. I'm Ross Wayne.